Well, this morning we've witnessed a dedication. Andy and Claire dedicating themselves to the task of Christian parenthood. At a most basic level, they dedicated themselves to being good parents to Isabella, something that most, if not all, parents aspire. And it's about which something that most, if not all, parents have a fear of failure, a fear of not measuring up to their own ideals of parenthood. There's a book called Mummy Guilt that quotes research that 96% of parents feel guilty about some aspect of their parenting. Although, if you paid attention, you may have noticed that there are often subtle differences between the two genders, between what fathers and mothers expect of themselves, the list of expectations that we have as parents. I think my list is relatively representative of most fathers, in that I set the bar pretty low and most of the time I clear it quite satisfactorily. My list includes things like, have I avoided causing them death or other serious injury today? Check. Have I provided food for them today? Check, and I have the empty chip packets to prove it. Have I waved the iron in the general direction of their clothing so that I can answer, at least with some degree of integrity, my wife's question, did you iron their clothes before they went to school? Check. As a father, have I spent more than the Australian average of 1 minute per day with my children? Per child or together? Let's say check anyway, okay? Survey says I'm a good father. On to the next thing. Now, I don't even know my wife's specific list, but I suspect that, like most mothers, it contains items such as, did I dedicate my entire day to providing mentally stimulating and emotionally enriching learning experiences which will help my children actualize their full potential as human beings? Rate yourself on a scale from zero to Mary Poppins. But deep down, mums and dads, when we're serious about it, we all worry about measuring up as parents. We worry about falling short of our own expectations. And it's not just as parents, it's all areas of life. We fear failure as a spouse. We fear falling short as a friend, or not measuring up in the way we conduct ourselves in our career. And for the 2/3 of Australians who believe in God, there's a fear of not meeting his standards too. I suppose a quick flip through the Ten Commandments shows that fear is quite justified. But even without knowing God's laws, even without a knowledge of God, the Bible says that we all violate our own consciences, at least at some point. It says that none of us can be perfect in meeting even our own standards. We're all guilty at some point of hurting others or of acting in a way that is contrary to our own values. All have sinned. And psychologists would say that much human behaviour can be explained as trying to make up for our shortcomings, seeking to atone for our own guilt. Well, this morning I want to take you through the story of one man's struggle with his feelings of guilt. His almost debilitating awareness that he fell short of his own standards, that he failed to meet other people's expectations, and ultimately and most importantly, that he was unable to keep God's law. He was a young German man born into a middle-class family. His father, a strong disciplinarian, raised him to value austerity and hard work. As an adolescent, he was sent away to a cathedral school where he excelled in Latin scholarship. And at the end of that, his father then made great financial sacrifices in order to send him to one of the prestigious universities around where he hoped that one day he'd become a lawyer. But a few weeks later, just a few weeks into his law degree, at age 22, he made a decision that absolutely shocked his family. He left the university to become a monk, to join a monastery. Now, what would prompt that decision? What would make someone give up that promising career in order to join a monastery? Well, there's a series of things that had happened. Earlier that year, two of his friends had died unexpectedly. He himself had suffered a life-threatening injury. And it seems that his entry into the monastery was prompted by a fear of his own death, his own mortality, and the fact that he would be judged by God at the end of it all and found wanting. It all came to a head one night when he was travelling through the night and he was in a thunderstorm, and there was a lightning strike quite close to him, which is always a sign that God isn't pleased with you, right? And so in sheer terror, he made a bargain with God. He said, spare my life, and I will become a monk. I will serve you. And so he began to study the Bible, applying his great mind and his love of the classics to his work. He was also initiated into monastic life, the daily cycle of prayers and menial chores and general monkeying about, whatever it is they do. After 7 years, he made quick work of his studies. He graduated with his doctorate in theology. Yet it didn't make him feel any better. In fact, it only made things worse. I mean, here he was teaching others the Bible, but he himself was still unsettled about his own state before God. He had continual feelings of guilt, which he tried desperately to assuage. He tried to make up for his shortcomings through hard work, through self-sacrifice, through acts of piety. Trying to do something that would make God pleased with him, that would attract God's favor to him. At the time, he wrote, "I was myself a monk for 20 years and so plagued myself with prayers, fastings, wakings, and freezings that I almost died of cold. What else did I seek through this but God? Who else was to see how I observed the rules and lived such a rigid life?" He was trying to please God by his actions. Not only this, but he would spend hours in the confessional booth, wearing out the people who were listening to his confession to the point where sometimes they had to take shifts. You know, he'd confess all the sins he could think of, but then he'd think of one more and he'd run back into the confessional booth, time after time, running back as he remembered a sin to go and confess it, to try and alleviate his guilt. He wrote, "I tried as hard as I could to keep the rule. I used to be contrite and make a list of my sins. I confessed them again and again. I scrupulously carried out the penances which were allotted to me. And yet my conscience kept nagging. It kept telling me, 'You fell short there. You were not sorry enough. You left that sin off your list.' I was trying to cure the doubts and scruples of the conscience with human remedies and the traditions of men. The more I tried these remedies, the more troubled and uneasy my conscience grew." Well, his superior at the monastery got a little sick of him, probably a little sick of having to hear all these confessions, and so he decided a holiday would be a good idea. And he sent him on a visit to Rome to see if going to the holy city might cure him. So he visited all the holy places and said Mass at some of the most famous altars. He dutifully crawled up the Scala Sancta, the holy steps at St. John's and the Lateran. And there he would kiss every step and recite the Lord's Prayer each time he did. But this didn't alleviate his doubts, only made them worse. Gave him a bad case of athlete's mouth as well, I guess. But his sense of sin and guilt remained. Of his trip to Rome, he said, "I went with onions and left with garlic." That is, he came back completely unsatisfied with the same thing that he had before. By this time, he declared that he didn't love God. He actually hated God, this God whom he could never please, no matter how much he tried. And one of the things he hated the most about God is found in Romans chapter 1, which was read to us earlier, those verses 16 to 17. Let's read them again. He says, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel. It's the power of God for salvation to everyone who has faith, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed through faith for faith. As it is written, the one who is righteous will live by faith." It was that phrase in the middle there, "the righteousness of God," which made him angry. He and many other scholars before him had taken this to mean God's perfect standard, God's own righteous perfection, that perfection that we could never, ever hope to live up to. And here is the Apostle Paul writing in a letter to the Romans that in the gospel, which means good news, in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed. He was thinking, how on earth is that good news? He says, "Whenever I heard this phrase, the righteousness of God, it struck my conscience like lightning. It was like a thunderbolt in my heart." For him, all the good news of Jesus Christ did was remind him of how sinful he was, of how utterly guilty he was before God. He was studying this passage over and over in a small room in a tower late into the night, one of many long nights that he spent wrestling over this part of the Bible. And then he began to focus on the second part of this verse, a quotation from the Old Testament book of Habakkuk that says, "The righteous one will live by faith." He says, "Suddenly a light dawned on me." He realized the righteousness of God was not referring to God's perfect standard that we couldn't live up to. It was actually talking about the gift of right standing with God, the gift of being righteous, something which is given by God to those who have faith in Jesus. We won't be condemned because we can't live up to the righteousness of God. Rather, this verse says we will live because God has given us his own righteousness as a gift. to those who have faith. And this is indeed good news. Now, I suppose if he'd been a little bit more aware about the customs of ancient speech writing, then the Pfennig might have dropped a little bit sooner. You see, this in a speech such as Paul's message to the Romans, you'd give a summary of your main idea near the beginning. After you got all the pleasantries out of the way, you give a summary of your main idea, which is the first two verses we read in chapter 1, verses 16 to 17. And then, after developing it a while, you come back and give a larger statement of your thesis. And that's what Paul is doing in what we call chapter 3. Have a listen to how Paul then goes on to expand or explain this idea of the righteousness of God. Verse 21 of chapter 3, he says, "But now a righteousness from God, apart from law, has been made known, to which the law and the prophets," that is the Old Testament, including the book of Habakkuk, "the law and the prophets testify. The righteousness from God comes through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. There's no difference, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified freely by his grace through the redemption that came by Christ Jesus." You see, our German friend had been right in one thing, that he didn't measure up to God's standard of righteousness. No one does. And because of that, God offers his righteousness. God offers his perfection. We are made right, even though we are not right. It's by an act external to us, not by our own effort. It's a gift. How is this possible? How can God permit such a what really is a travesty of justice as to declare right those who are wrong? The answer of how God can do this is simple, yet it's profound. Someone else must pay the penalty. And that someone else was none other than God himself in the person of Jesus. Paul goes on to say, God presented him, that is Jesus, as a sacrifice of atonement through faith in his blood. A sacrifice of atonement. Jesus' death in our place that pays the penalty for our sin, that takes away our guilt. And that's it. End of story. It's all been done for us. There's a famous story told of a Bible college where the students were sitting their final exam for one of their theology subjects. And when the students opened up their theology paper, they were astonished to find that every answer had actually already been filled in. And at the bottom of the page, there was a message that read, "This is the final exam. This is the end of the exam. All the answers on your test are correct. You will receive a high distinction for your exam. The reason you passed the test is because the creator of the test took it for you. And all the work you've done in preparation for this test, or not, did not help you get the high distinction. You've just experienced grace." Now, I teach at a Bible college myself, which leads me to suspect that story is made up. I mean, we're not like that. How would that fit the bell curve? But the point of the story remains in that it has all been done for us. All the work we've done for the final exam on our life, it doesn't count for anything because the creator of the test has sat it for us. We don't have to do penance. We don't have to beat ourselves up or go over our life with a microscope trying to remember every single sin in order to confess it and then make amends. We don't have to climb a set of stairs in Rome chanting the Lord's Prayer every time. We don't have to live in a monastery and wake up at 4 a.m. every day in order to pray to make God pleased with us, in order to somehow win God over so that he might love us. He's already shown that he loves us by making things right for us. We don't have to do anything. It's all been done. And that revolutionary discovery made in the tower by our friend many centuries ago was life-changing for him. After that, he writes, when he contemplated that phrase, the righteousness of God, which he'd hated so much, he says, "Now I felt completely different." He wrote, "I extolled my sweetest word with a love as great as the hatred with which I had before hated the word righteousness of God. Thus that place in Paul was for me truly the gate to paradise." From that point onwards, his life changed. He began to write against the man-made religious system that had for so long kept him trapped by his own guilt, kept him trying to make up for his failures, atone for his sins. He wrote against a system that claimed to pardon sin on God's behalf in exchange for penance or for good works or even for money given to the church. He wrote a lot, 95 papers in all, which on October 31, 1517, in the absence of the internet, he decided to nail them to the door of the cathedral in Wittenberg. And so this young monk named Martin Luther gave birth to what we now know as the Protestant Reformation. And this movement swept across Germany over the next decade or so, forming with it what is now the State Church of Germany, the Lutheran Church. Other European countries soon followed, like Switzerland under the leadership of John Calvin, and then England under Henry VIII and his key bishop Thomas Cranmer. It didn't stop there. This movement changed the course of history. And today there are an estimated 800 million Protestant Christians across the world, partly because this one man brought us back to the original message of Jesus, the original message of the gospel. The good news that right standing with God is available to us for free. Yet despite this, there are still people in Protestant churches, in Lutheran churches, in Anglican churches, in Baptist churches just like this one, people who are still trying to earn favour with God, just like Luther was. Still trusting in their own works, still thinking that they have to do something in order to make themselves acceptable to God. What about you? Are you still like a young Luther, crawling up the stairs, hoping to please God, hoping to earn his favour? Are you forever going back into the confessional booth, trying to make up for your mistakes, trying to atone for your own sins? Are you living in fear of the righteousness of God, his standard that you can never live up to? Or maybe you don't think like that at all. Maybe you think the opposite. Maybe you think that you've done enough already to make yourself acceptable to God. That you've done enough good to outweigh the bad you've done. Turn up to church every so often, you put a bit of money in the plate as it comes around, do unto others, that sort of thing, and everything will be okay. I mean, God's a nice bloke. At the end of the day, he'll overlook my failures and let me into heaven, won't he? Well, the Bible does tell us that God is a nice bloke. Nicer than you could possibly imagine. But he won't just overlook our failures. He won't just overlook our sin, our willful rebellion against him. That would be to condone evil. That would make God unjust. The only way God can accept us, the only basis in which he can admit us into his presence, is if we trust what Jesus has done for us on the cross. That's what faith means. Trusting in Jesus' death in my place. As it is written, the righteous by faith will live. If you're still trusting in your own effort to make yourself acceptable to God, I urge you this morning to give it up, because you can't do it. As I said in the beginning, it's not possible even to live up to our own standards 100% of the time, let alone God's perfect standard. Instead, place your faith in Jesus. Receive the gift of God's own righteousness, right standing with him, given to those who simply believe.